Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and my very special guest today is Stephen Street. Since 2015, Stephen has been the CEO of Cubed Talent Management, and that is incorporating Cubed Recruitment, Indigo Healthcare Recruitment, and Cubed Academy. According to Stephen's LinkedIn profile, this represents an entirely new approach to strategic talent management for the engineering, FMCG, electronics, and manufacturing and supply chain sectors. Stephen started his recruiting career over 25 years ago, and he started his own business called Relay Recruiting in 1996, which he subsequently sold to Staffforce in 2011. Stephen, welcome. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Morning, Mark.
So you were referred to me by Darren Ledger at iIntro. So thanks to Darren for introducing us. And I actually interviewed the iIntro chairman, Plamen Ivanov. That's episode 43 for people who want to revisit that that conversation. How do you know the guys at iIntro?
Plamen and I, our paths crossed many years ago, probably 25, maybe even 30 years ago. Plamen was not in recruitment at the time. I had just moved into recruitment, and then I think the next time I saw him, I think he was up at the Golf Club, and it was at that point I realised he was involved with Grass Green. I did a little bit of work with them, so after selling Relay, I did 2.5-3 years of consulting, and Grass Green were one of my clients. I had a great relationship with Plamen and Paul. Did some good stuff together. I learned a lot from them. In fact, they could be sending me an invoice rather than the other way around. So it was a good relationship. and I think philosophically, we're very aligned in and outside of, you know, our jobs and our work.
Absolutely. Plamen's a great guy and quite a character. It's funny you say about, you know, you paying them for the consulting work you did with them. I think that's the nature of coaching and consulting. I learn from every client I work with. And so although, you know, clients are paying me to help them, it really is a two-way, you know, discovery process. So I'd love to talk about like you selling your business and then also the really innovative things you're doing with Cubed Talent Management. But before we get into that, can we just go right back to the beginning? And would you like tell us your story? Because I believe you came from quite humble beginnings and in Yorkshire. How did you come to be where you are today?
So I think being dragged up is a sort of an English, maybe a Northern colloquialism. And you remember the game Top Trumps, where you'd have like cards with data on them and statistics. So the running joke is if there was a top trumps game of being sort of dragged up, humble beginnings, typically amongst my peer group, they used to say, Steve, get your top trumps out and tell us that story again. So it was fairly tricky early days, but it's not a misery memoir. You kind of look back and go, you know what, I learned a lot and that shaped me and that informed me and that you know, that kind of gave me my worldview. So it was a bit rough initially, but you know, I wasn't my own. I think it was fairly typical from where I was brought up. So I was brought up in inner city Bradford, born in 1963, brought up by a single mum. And I woke up on Christmas Eve on my, still 15 at the time, to be told my mum had died. I wasn't aware she was ill. What you learn, you know, when you look back is, that's kind of how things were done. You didn't want to worry anybody, didn't want to make a fuss. You kind of just took one day at a time. But I didn't realize at the time that was going to be life-changing. Kind of just deal with it and didn't have this sort of emotional or psychological maturity to process it. Just get on with it. So comfortably numb, you might say, about the whole thing. I didn't know what I didn't know. So then fast forward, I ended up in, you know, a bedsit with some mates in a flat, enjoyed it. I didn't think, you know, I was hard done to or I was deprived or anything really, just kind of got on with it and enjoyed it. And then had a few jobs. I was on the Students' Union for a few years. I was social facilities officer. Then I became the social officer, so I was booking bands. buying beer, running a couple of bars. And that's, I think, when I realized there was a degree of entrepreneurialism in there. And I suppose where that came from was at my mum's funeral, there was this big sort of cathartic, well, we need to tell you a little bit more about your upbringing. So it turns out my dad was an illiterate Irish guy who came over in the 50s, ended up running a pub. My mum worked for him. The rest is history. So I was quite proud of that. Yeah, I was never embarrassed about that. I kind of wore it as a bit of a badge of honour. Quite liked it. I thought it was different. Anyway, so there's clearly a bit of that kind of rub off in terms of making money, running a business, promoting the business, doing some good stuff. Then I was an estate agent, funny enough, for about 3.5 years, and I enjoyed that, the interaction with customers, getting out there, putting the houses on, getting them sold, negotiating, transacting the whole piece. So the recruitment gateway, I suppose, is like a lot of people in recruitment, very few people in recruitment, you contrive to be in recruitment where there was a clear career pathway or an intent or a qualification or, do you know what I mean? It was kind of people fall into it. And pretty much everybody I've ever met has fallen into, but no one's really sort of contrived to get into recruitment. But I was out of work and I went to register with a company called LinkUp back in the day, early 1993, ostensibly for whatever job they had. I was happy. It was an industrial recruitment company. So, you know, have you got a job? I need an income, got kids, all the rest of it, let's go. And when I got home, they rang me and said, can you come back in? I'd like to talk to you about a couple of things. I went back in. I thought they had a job for me. And they said, oh, we think you'd be good in recruitment. I said, I don't even know what it is. What do you do? So they explained what they did. I went, right, okay. Well, I never heard of it before. But, right, well, if you think you think I could do it, let's give it a go. So I went in on a fairly big intake of people. I remember being in a boardroom with a load of people all dressed in suits and thinking these people kind of know a lot more about this than I do. And fast forward about 3 months, I think there were 3 or 4 of us left. So the attrition was massive. I think it was about 25, 30 people on the intake. There were 4 of us left. Oh, it was brutal. Brutal, but I was desperate. It was like a heady combination of, I was desperate, needed the job and needed the income. I didn't want to fail. And I surprised myself, I suppose, on a daily basis that was sort of still in the game. So that was LinkUp. I left for various reasons, ended up at Pertemps. Had about 2 years with Pertemps, great company, a lot of time for them, taught me a lot. In fact, had I not gone on to set up Relay with a colleague, I can imagine that I'd probably have invested the rest of my career in Pertemps. Good company. Ticked all the
great
boxes
business,
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was it, really. No.
Wow.
Nothing unique about that, I don't think.
Well, I beg to differ, Stephen, but, you know, it's an amazing story for sure. Let's just dig into the early success in recruiting, which you said, you know, you're surprised on a daily basis to still be there. What was the difference, do you think, between the people that fell away, they couldn't, you know, couldn't make it versus you? I know you said it was part desperation, you needed the job, you needed the income, but there must be more to it than that.
I think going back to LinkUp, they invested heavily in us, you know, training. And at a time when legislation was at best light touch, it was non-existent. There was no minimum wage, no working time, no agency worker regulations, nothing. No good work plan, nothing. Yeah, you know, in the days of £1 an hour and all that nonsense. But I think Larry Gould, who owned and ran the business, was very ethical. The bar was high from the get-go, even though the market didn't really require the bar to be that high. I don't want to be disparaging about an industry that's been very good to me, but I always thought historically the barrier of entry into recruitment was too low, mm-hmm. too low. And I think when you consider the complexity of what we do, the value of the account, the reputations at stake, I feel that that was a real anomaly, but LinkUp spotted that. So you were basically hot housed in terms of training, a lot of pressure to learn and know everything from legislation to compliance to how to sell to how to account manage, plus some of the early technology. It was the best possible place for me, best possible place. So I think those foundations and those fundamentals were set very early on. I've got high standards as an individual. And one of my many guiding principles, because we've all got them, haven't we? But one of my guiding principles, what I recognized very early on, was not to be function to function, i.e. recruiter to hirer, supplier to customer, nor be brand to brand, i.e. link up to whoever it might be, the client company, but for it to be person to person, Steve to Mark, Steve to whoever it might be, from the get-go. Because when you strip away the person's function and the purpose, position and the nature of the relationship, at the core of all of that universally is a person where, in all likelihood, you have shared values, worldview, commonality, kids, family, where you live, what you do, what you enjoy, what you think, what you believe, all of that. So I always had a knack of getting quite close to people quickly, but again, very authentically. And a lot of people who are in my sort of personal friendship group now, I've known for 20, 25 years. And a lot of them start, in fact, my business partner started off as a customer. So my business partner is Rob Fleming. He was one of the founding directors of Pace Micro, very big success story in consumer electronics. He was a customer, then he was a client, then we got close, and then we got closer, and he became unwittingly a mentor to me. So very early on, I recognized that I've got limitations. There's lots of things I don't know, lots of things I don't understand. So I sort of asked certain people, usually and typically clients, if they'd be prepared to mentor me informally, enter into a sort of informal joint venture to inform my own thinking, my own strategy, help me develop innovations in our service, what we do, how we do it, and why we do it. And the way I used to frame it, Mark, not talking too much, am I?
Nope. This is great stuff.
The way I used to frame it is, and I still do, Mark, and anybody can have this because it works. I say to clients, and I lean in conspiratorially and say, look, imagine this for a minute. You know, imagine this for me. Imagine that we, the three people around the table, so this could be an operations manager, an owner manager, head of HR. Imagine that the four of us created our own agency, and that agency only existed to service the needs of this organization over the life of its strategic vision. Do you believe we would put together a more informed, a more effective, and a more appropriate strategy than a load of strangers who currently sit outside of this organization? What's the answer? Yes. Now, the reason most people don't do that is they don't have the political will. They often don't have the headspace, the expertise, but they've never been invited to even consider it. So that's how I frame all of my relationships with clients from the get-go. And I don't see the risk of, but they might take it in-house. I don't see that as a risk. It's a bit like jujitsu. What I see as a sort of a risk is to bring that on. Yes, let's take it in-house, but let's take it in that house in the form of a joint venture, in the form of a joint enterprise, where a combination of what you know and can do and what I know and can do together equals more than the sum of our parts. Show me a better way of doing it than that. That's kind of what I did from the get-go, just intuitively, and still do.
That is quite genius, Steve. I would love to find out more about this philosophy of joint venturing with your clients, whether that is formally or informally. And I love the idea of cultivating your clients as mentors as well. I've cultivated mentors throughout my career, and I think one of the keys to my own success is, I mean, of course, I've hired coaches, which has been great. I've learned from every client, as we said earlier. So you learn, you know, from your customers, but also seeking out and cultivating mentors, I think, really can accelerate your own development. It's interesting because I interviewed a woman called Natasha Makajani. That's episode number 30. And she's excellent at opening relationships at the C-level and winning big accounts, even though she's a small boutique business owner. And part of her strategy is similar to what you've just described, where she's approaching senior leaders who she's researched and she admires, and she pursues them in a very intelligent way. It's not a scattergun approach. She's going after people who she would like to learn from and get to know, and asks them for help, asks if she can meet them for lunch or a coffee. And, you know, some of them are now non-exec directors for her recruitment business, and they started out as clients. So I think there's something to that. And I love your, I'm just recapping here what I've taken from the first thing you've said, Stephen, which is developing that relationship on a person-to-person level rather than just a business-to-business level. I'm not afraid to speak to anybody. I don't really respect job titles. I think human beings, by virtue of us being born on this planet, we have equal value, and everyone has the same needs. We all have worries. We all have, you know, things we're stressed about. We all have goals, desires, dreams, families. We need to eat, sleep, and, you know, all the basic human functions are the same. So if we can remove the artifice of job titles and, you know, fancy offices and so on, and get down to it, then we can put ourselves on the same level, really, as the clients we're interacting with.
I think going back to that, yeah. You know, that approach, which is, you could argue it's tactical, because what you're doing is disrupting the sort of orthodox conventional thinking and dynamics that typically exist. But it's you're right in what you're saying there. It's about, you know, being comfortable in your own skin as a human being and as an individual and as an equal. And that kind of trumps everything. And that's really where people, in terms of alignment, connectedness, common ground, that's where that's very quickly sort of established and it's meaningful. But often I say to a client, if we take a period of time, let's say just 2 years, and say, so which accountants do you use? And they go, oh, well, we use KPMG. All right, okay. So who does your auditing? Oh, yeah, PwC. All right, so who does your facilities management? All right, okay. So these are really long-standing relationships. And they go, yeah. And I can see that they're strategic partnerships. I understand that. How many agencies have you used across the group in the same time period? Well, many, many, many. Well, why is that? Well, we're all crap. No. The common denominator is you. Yeah. And actually, they're complicit because they allow themselves to be bullied and cowed into doing the same thing all over again, probably for a lower fee or charge. So the other thing I say to clients at the outset is, at the beginning of this relationship, we're going to make a conscious decision. And I'm thinking of somebody in particular who considers, let's call Mark. No pushover. You know, he was a big M&E client of ours. Let's just get rid of that. A big M&E client of ours. And I said, look, Mark, we're going to enter into, and he's very cynical about agencies. And I think he was on his 18th agency in the last 3 years. You go, okay, well, you're part of the problem, Mark, like it or not. So we're either going to be one of two things. We're either going to be stakeholders in our shared success, or we're going to be complicit in our inevitable failure based on what we do next. And if you're going to ask me to do what everybody else has done for the same or lesser fee, you need to find somebody else. It's time to listen. Now, what I don't do is sell concepts, which is sell hypothetically. I frame everything and contextualize everything within a case study. This is a real organization, credible organization in the same sector with similar issues. This was the before, and here's the hard data, and this is the after, and the hard supporting data, irrefutable data, and this is the how. This is how we took them from where they were to where they are now. Now, I didn't do that to them. We did it together, because they realized it was time now to collaborate authentically and correctly from the get-go. Not call it a partnership, but betray everything about that in their behavior and their interaction by kicking down. Yeah, but they genuinely entered into and embraced a true collaboration. Now, you only get that really when you work at the top of organizations where the power and the influence is, And people generally are more comfortable in their own skin and appreciate this kind of conversation. That's what I found from my own experience.
That is beautiful. I love how you just described that. And the way that you're framing the conversation, it's very easy to, this word partnership is one, and I've done it myself, is use the word, but what does that really mean? You know, it's easy to use the word, but then betray that with your behavior on both sides, as you've just said. And I agree that what you're suggesting, as amazing and beautiful as that sounds, is only going to work if you do have the ear of the most senior people in that organization, which is in itself, I mean, that can be a challenge. Can we just discuss that briefly? Like, how do you get to that point? Because sometimes because you can either work your way up, which means working in a non-ideal way for a time period until you get some traction, and then you can get to that person who then allows you, you know, but then by then you've already been working. They're used to you working in a certain way, and they're inclined to not, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. They're saying, well, but Mark, you're delivering good people to us in the old way. So why would we change it? And I kind of feel like I don't like that philosophy of, well, we'll go in as a one of many suppliers, and then we'll, you know, do some good work, and then we'll get exclusive, and then we'll get you to the next stage. Because I feel like you're already de-positioning yourself. I would prefer from the get-go to enter into the relationship and just say, look, as you've just described, you've been through 18 different agencies. Let's not repeat the same, you know, mistakes that have taken you to this point. Let's try something new. But how do you get the ear of this, of the senior stakeholders?
I think it goes back to fundamentals, Mark. So right at the very beginning, you get, you know, the training is about, let's identify the stakeholder groups within an organization. You've got the end user, you've got people with influence, you've got people who facilitate, and you've got people with authority, the decision and decision-making powers. And I think you have to look at each scenario and opportunity on a case-by-case basis and put together a mini strategy for it. So we have these tactical approach plans, and the first thing is to know who's who. Then understand what their agenda is and what's important to them, and not to disrespect anybody within that organization. And if that means going in, you know, on the ground floor and establishing those relationships on our merit, because and this has to be on our merit, those people will refer up, and those people and also to make sure that we're doing our bit to, you know, shine the spotlight on those individuals who've been enlightened enough and open-minded enough and receptive enough to listen to new and better ways of doing things, and for them to refer that up, and then again and again and again. Or you can sometimes go in at the top, but of course what happens as you sort of move through your career, the people who are maybe working on the shop floor have moved into middle management have moved into executives have moved into, you know, their business owners or their part of the C-suite, whatever. I think that's important to be able to stay, you know, staying in the game is important, because your peer group, you tend to kind of rise with the tide. As long as you've maintained those relationships and you've not been a fair weather friend, and I know other recruiters can be quite transactional. It's just about getting that person placed, getting that fee and moving on. And I think recruiters perhaps might want to think about, well, if I've been in recruitment 10 years, what's the quality of my professional network without overstating the quality of my relationship with clients? So how many are genuinely advocating for me? How many can I sort of refer a prospective client to who would sing my praises and would reassure that person about my capabilities, performance, and contribution to what they're trying to do? How many would only ever use me exclusively, and wherever they go, I'm their first call or one of their? And if you've not built up that kind of network after a couple of years, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, then I would say your relationship is way too transactional. It's like starting again every single time, which is exhausting. So that is about speed. That is about price. And that is about look rather than goodwill and reputation, personal brand, being somebody to do good business with. But also when you're not actively doing business, is to keep checking in with those people authentically and building that goodwill and nurturing those relationships and letting them know you're there because you're there, not because there's a fee or a project, you know, up for grabs. Something very uncomfortable about that for me.
Yes, I love it. That's a great answer. And I'm going to also answer my own question, if that's right, yeah, Steve, which is doing this sort of thing, podcasting, for example, is a great way of building relationships with senior individuals. So as you say, you can, if you do a great job of building real relationships instead of operating transactionally, you can, as you grow and mature, your peer group also is rising through the ranks. But in some cases, for example, I had a client, you talked about case studies. So the case study I'm going to give you is a young woman called Lauren Steibing, who's hopefully listening to this or will listen to it when it goes live. And she was very early in her career, didn't have that network of senior, you know, stakeholders, wanted to win retained search assignments with big blue chip companies. And these companies all have PSLs and, you know, approved vendors and, you know, headhunters that they already have relationships with and so on. And I suggested she do a podcast and invite C and VP level contacts on her show as a way of just getting to know people. And she has done that. It's been extremely successful for her. She's done about 60 or so episodes now, and that's opened many, many doors for her. So I think there can be shortcuts if you're strategic about how you do things. But in the long run, it does come down to the, you know, having the conversation is one thing, but then building relationship is another thing. Let me ask you this. When I first approached you about doing this interview, I thought what I was going to want to talk to you about is building and selling a company. But maybe we can come back to that on another occasion, because I wanted to stay with this idea of partnering with your clients. I think it's really fascinating. And I have not come across really anyone else who's doing this. I know you've written to me before about the importance of innovation recruitment. And by innovation, we're not just talking about technology or process, but you said there's a need to radically reposition the sector, challenge perceptions and truisms about the industry within the market by collaborating and forging strategic alliances with clients and maybe even other recruiters to unlock the hidden value. Could you elaborate on that? Like what you're doing at, Cubed Talent Management in that respect, I'd be really interested to learn more.
I think it's a combination of recruitment generally, I think, but it's open for, you know, dispute or debate. It's quite tribal. It's quite tribal and polarizing. Well, as a sector, if the value is 35, 36 billion to the UK economy, you know, it's very fragmented. There's the kind of big players, and then a really long tail of sort of SMEs, owner managed and micros, and one person bands. And I don't know whether that's a kind of paranoia, a lack of sort of maturity generally, and I don't mean maturity of individual, but just generally a need for the sector to mature. And there's a lot of cannibalization and a lot of damage done as we all go at, you know, an opportunity. It could be an account, it could be a job, it could be a project. We all go at that and kind of tear it to pieces between ourselves. Yeah, and the poor client and the candidates are somewhere in that melee. That just strikes me as being a bit undignified and a bit unprofessional and really a bit self-centered, collectively self-centered, if that's not a contradiction in terms. where we go, well, let's position, let's put the client and the candidate, let's remind ourselves of the most important people in the equation. So first thing we need to do is treat them with respect and dignity and get in their shoes and try and feel what it's like to be on the receiving end of this experience. And instead of seeing every competitor as the enemy, let's have a look at perhaps where that competitor plus us plus a really good strategy and an open-minded and collaborative client could really see everything off. Basically, that's it. You're really going to start to kind of negate and mitigate all the inevitable risks. So I kind of run the movie forward, Mark, and think, well, what about if the client sort of cottons onto the idea that their perception is this is money for old rope, it's a necessary evil, it's not a particularly nice experience, and a lot of value, a lot of cash is going out of the organisation. So I sit with the individual and say, well, look, what was your agency spend on perms last year? This is a real life situation. 850 grand, that's a stack of money. No wonder you're being asked whether you're getting value for money. No wonder you're toying with the idea of perhaps doing it differently. You're not quite sure how you're going to do it differently. Let me show you how you might do it differently. What you might do is you might decide to take it in-house, but let me explain, you know, what some of the pitfalls are. Conceptually, it's a great idea, but in execution, there's quite a lot of downside. Because what you're saying to me is you're going to recruit somebody from commercial recruitment, you know, basically out there, hard recruitment, in-house, and it'll be really easy for them. It won't be any easier for them because they're still competing in a very dynamic, a very competitive and quite aggressive marketplace, but they're now on a salary, yeah, with no commission and no bonus. So, you know, I don't want to be disparaging or disrespectful to people who go in-house, but why would you go in-house on 35, 40 grand when you can sit outside and be as good as you claim to be on twice, three times, four times that? And have all the sort of, you know, the blend of businesses that are out there. So let me show you another way. So what we could do perhaps is give you the platform, the technology, the resource, the capability and the tools out of the box to do this. Yeah, to effectively bring your recruitment capability in-house. But what we're going to do, we're still going to post that £850,000 as an internal sale. So we're still going to show that. But it's going to be managed by the internal team. So you're going to have a recruiter, and that's going to be a member of my team. You're going to have a resourcer, and that's going to be a member of my team. But we're going to dial cubed down. So we're going to stop talking about cubed and the brand and cubed as being the identity. And we're going to dial your brand up. Yeah, so we're going to badge everything up, everything, you know, up in your name, because that's really what we need to be putting out there. You're losing the opportunity to raise your own profile, your own brand as a destination employer by allowing agencies to piggyback on your brand. Let's turn them down and turn them off. So that's what we're going to do out of the box. We're going to give you all the training plans, all the best practice, all the process, everything to do this from scratch. This is where it gets interesting. So we're going to use a gain share model. So we're still going to post these sales up here. We're going to agree that there's going to be some capital investment for technology, subscriptions, LinkedIn, CRM, you name it, applicant tracking software. There's your CapEx. But you can see it. You can't see it at the minute. And there's your operating expenditure. That's what it's actually going to cost to run it on a daily basis. The team, everything. What drops out of the bottom is £630,000. Which previously was going out of the organization and into the coffers of all of these agencies, none of which are strategically aligned with you. They're aligned with themselves as individuals. They're not aligned around your vision, your mission, and how you're going to get there. We are. £630,000. Year one, we're going to rebate 25% of that back to you. So you get all of these benefits. You get exclusivity over the candidate, because at the minute, these candidates are applying to all of these agencies. You get no visibility. You've got no control. You don't know whether you're getting the best candidate. You've got no control over the narrative. You've got no control over what's been said and done to these candidates in your name. You bring all of that in-house. You get all of that agency. You get that control. You control the narrative. You have visibility over the candidates. And you have control and influence over the candidate journey and experience. And particularly in organizations where your product or service is B2C, these people, particularly the ones that are unsuccessful, you want to make sure that they remain loyal to the brand. Yeah, they've had a great experience. You don't switch them off your product and service because you've not given them a correct experience as an applicant who applied in good faith. So there are all the reasons I'm going to give you for to do this. Now, often the companies say, we don't have the political will, we don't have a mandate from the board, it's just too much for us right now. However, we want to do something like that with you. That's kind of how it goes with pretty much everybody. And for smaller organizations that say, well, we don't spend anything like that, well, why don't we create a strategic alliance? Because you plus that other SME, plus that other SME, plus that other SME, this will work. And you can share this capability as a hub and have all the benefits that I've just laid out for you. That's what I mean about disrupting how we do things. It's really nothing about the technology. It's really nothing about the fundamentals of recruitment. It's really about rethinking our relationship with clients and showing them something different. And they'll either go for it or they won't. But when they don't, you've really got them thinking about what's just been put to them, always. Which paves the way or creates a platform then to have a more traditional or conventional conversation about what happens next. So it's a win-win for me.
What I love about that is, I mean, it's such a cool concept, but as you say, it's a win-win because if they say yes, then great. If they say no or not yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Already you've established that you are genuinely different to the other suppliers they're talking to, and they, you know, innovative in your thinking and collaborative in your approach, which can only be a good thing for the foundations of the relationship, right?
Yeah.
And it also keeps the door open to revisit that conversation at a later stage, which is fantastic. Can I just really try and understand this model a little better? By the way, is this just one example of several that you've tried, or is this kind of
over the years, before it became a thing, Mark, before it became something that we can sort of present and show the mechanics, the strategy, how it's implemented, you know, how it's delivered and executed, that was kind of the approach I sort of intuitively took anyway, which was, look, I've been trained and I've got some information. Plus, I've got a good appetite for more information and knowledge. Because I think, again, coming back to the complexity, the risk, you know, you're handling people's individual sort of brands and reputations, but you're also looking after the organization's brand and reputation. You know, you're an ambassador for it in what you do, and therefore, I think you have to think carefully about whether you've got the level of expertise and knowledge to add some real value, you know, not just be winging it. So I think historically it was about BD, it was about sales, it was about, you know, getting out there, converting, winning the business. But I think as the market's matured and it's become more complex, I think there's a lot of cynicism around the nature of recruitment and what recruiters do. So I always imagine that the client or the candidate has had a suboptimal experience with a recruiter, my first objective is to demonstrate to that person that it's going to be different and it's going to be better from the get-go.
Yes.
So for me, I think I can feel and sense that there's a shift in mood and sentiment. And I think clients are looking for something different, are looking for something better. They're just not quite sure what it is. So they default to, well, we'll just do it ourselves, rather than explore doing it as a joint venture, as a joint enterprise at whatever level. Because I'm not sure it's been tabled, because I think the sector sees in-house as a risk and a threat rather than an opportunity.
Really interesting. Now, just so I'm clear in my mind, what is the main difference between what you're proposing versus, say, an RPO model, which, you know, that's been prevalent for a number of years.
I call RPOs there's a middleman. There's two middlemen.
Okay.
So there's more dilution. It's less, you know, and often what's driving that is just about price. Because the way, you know, it's all about price. And, you know, so if really you can ask me how much it's going to cost, if that's one of the first things off your lips, then we're probably, you know, this is not going to be the relationship we're looking for. I'm asking for you to invest responsibly. You know, the old cliches and adages about you buy cheap, you buy twice and all the rest of it. But again, I think you're going to be talking to the right person and you've got to frame the proposition and you've got to evidence the proposition by pointing to other organizations who were once where they are, who are now in a better place, and how that thing sort of evolves over time. It's not for everybody, as I say, but it is a concept that I talk about a lot. It's a reality for us as a business. And I think there's the market is very receptive to these ideas, as long as they're properly articulated.
Yes. Wow. I love this joint venture strategy or business model. I mean, do you have a name for this or like this approach, and how does it actually work in practice?
Yeah. So the way we're set up, we've got our sort of conventional sort of cube core over here. So temps and perms, high street, traditional recruitment. We've got our Indigo Healthcare over here, which is sort of on the sort of NH framework and off framework, which is international doctors. We've got on-site managed services to the side of that, which is where we're embedded, usually sort of volume, multi-site complex. And then we have a standalone business unit that we call strategic partnerships. And if you unpack that, there's three levels. So, and it generally starts with, okay, so let's transact with you as we typically would, but let's start to preemptively build a lot of this additional value in from the get-go, in a give to get. So let's almost project ourselves into a situation and a scenario where we are in-house. But and in terms of the collateral, so the resource we use to kind of get this story told, we basically explain, look, there's this sort of contingency outside in. But again, this is this sort of thought experiment. Let's imagine that you add your own sort of entity in-house. Let me explain the benefits of doing that. And, you know, I don't want to sort of repeat myself, but just going over, you have exclusivity over the candidates. You will have more candidates because actually most candidates would prefer to apply for a job direct and not be handled via an agency stroke middleman. It validates it. So more people apply and therefore you've got access to kind of more choice options and quality. Then I talk about the numbers and I talk about the synergies and the economies of scale. So, it is a standalone division. We call it strategic partnerships. On a very low level, we basically call those projects special projects. So they are different. We add more value in from the get-go around technology, process, applicant assessment. We're a Thomas International license center. So we do human job analysis and PPA. So this is, and we measure things like time to fill, right first time, candidate fit, the quality of the shortlist and retention. So we look at the metrics. So I think once we've proved that this methodology, technology and strategy adds immediate value and ongoing value, we then move to level two, where we're now considered to be a strategic partner. Level three is where we've entered into a joint venture. And that's where we basically unlock the gain share. So we transact with them on a sort of a usual fee-based basis initially. Then we add a little bit more value at level two. And level three is kind of the pinnacle where we've effectively moved the whole model to a gain share where there's a significant rebate back to the client. That's usually in year three. The rebate goes up in year two. The rebate goes up in year three. And the option I give them, Mark, is, and if you then want to take all of that in-house lock, stock and barrel and turn us off, feel free. And that again is authentic. and it's available to them. But no one's ever done that because actually it works, because what they do is they manufacture things. What they do is deliver a service. And what they've realized is they never really wanted to bring their recruitment in-house. It was more of a reaction and a response to the fact that they were just generally dissatisfied with the experience. So it's a kind of hybrid, if you like.
Amazing. I love that. Could you explain the word gain share? Because I don't know that term.
All right. So it's a bit of a commercial term. So that's the case of, well, look, currently let's say that what the gain, the upside, the value is all of those fees that are going out, to individual agencies or an agency, whatever it might be. So we'll run this little P&L. So we're still going to post all the placements that we make. We're still going to post that as a sale. Yeah, but it's a sale that's being effectively affected by the internal team. So let's put that number back up there. So let's use the same numbers as before, so £850,000. We've agreed that we've had to make some investment to have the infrastructure and the systems and the process and the platform. So let's say, for argument's sake, that's £20,000. And we've agreed that we want a team of two and a half people, a full-time recruiter, a full-time resourcer, talent acquisition specialist, and a digital marketing assistant who's effectively going to just make sure that we promote and we've turned everything up to 10 or everything up to 11 if you've seen Spinal Tap.
Yeah, Spinal Tap.
Nigel Tufnell, turn it up to 11. Get everything cranked up to 11. Yeah. So, and what I often say to clients, and this is true, you know what? You're possibly one of the best kept secrets in your sector. Because when we signpost people to your website, it says a lot about your heritage and your history and your technology and your process and your innovation and your customers and your market and your success. But none of that is translated for the consumption of candidates. And they're not motivated, nor are they qualified to work out why you would be a great place for them to invest their careers and their futures. That's what we're really good at, because we're marketeers. So going back to the gain share, so let's say there's your 850, we spent, for argument's sake, £200,000 running it, the 650 drops out the bottom, we're gonna give you 25% of that back. So your gain there is exclusivity over the candidates, more candidates, time to fill, fulfillment, right first time fill, raising your brand and profile, and all of these savings and efficiencies. And then there's a step up of that. So it goes from 25. It's negotiated on a case by case basis. But let's say, for argument's sake, in year one, there's nothing because that's, it's paying for itself. Year two, you're going to get a 25% rebate. Year three, you're going to get 33% rebate. Year four, we'll renegotiate the relationship. And if it's something you want to take offers and take in house and run yourself, there'll be a transfer fee because you're going to take the people, you're going to take the capability and intellectual property. If this is working for you and you want to sign up for another 3 years, let's do it. That's the idea.
That's awesome. By the way, just a note for our international listeners, you used the word high street. That simply, it means main street is how it's normally referred to in, say, North America. It would be main street rather than high street. And it just simply refers to a recruitment agency or staffing business that has a shop front, like Reed, Manpower, Adecco or whatever. Can I ask then, what you're proposing sounds like it would only apply if they haven't already gone down the road of building their own internal team. Am I understanding correctly? Or how would you approach it in a case where?
Yeah, because I don't think, unless that they've tried that and it's not worked, but to be honest with you, I've not come across that scenario. Often I think if they've taken that step, politically they've taken that step and ideologically, practically, and they've taken that step, I imagine that unless it's really gone badly wrong, they wouldn't necessarily. I think they will feel that they've transitioned from being at the mercy of third party agencies and they've brought it in house. But I went to the in-house recruitment awards a couple of years ago, but it wasn't what I would consider to be bringing a commercial, highly innovative, highly energized, highly competitive recruitment team in-house working in a dedicated way, completely aligned and embedded within that organization strategy, it just looked to me like they sort of renamed and rebranded pre-existing HR people. That's what it looked like to me.
Yeah. So then, Steve, does that mean that your sort of ideal target client for this is a smaller growing company rather than a PLC or?
No, not necessarily. I think the three main projects that we've got live at the minute are all significant. They're interestingly, they're all owned and managed, although one recently IPO'd, but they were up until very recently all owner managed. They're all sort of large manufacturing and or supply chain businesses. But I think what was key there, and they're long standing, so I think they've just got used to using agencies and, you know, whatever that looked like historically. And I think they were just ready to look at and explore something different. But it wasn't too much of a leap where it was just too outlandish, too left field, too radical. And on a scale, I say to people at the beginning, look, more of the same, conventional, maybe creative, maybe innovative, maybe radical, maybe disruptive. Let's start at disruptive and work back until we find what feels comfortable, feels like we're in the right territory. And almost always, they say, yeah, we want to probably go somewhere between radical and innovative, depending on what the prize and the payoff is. And if you can show us a way of achieving the things you're claiming we can achieve, we're all ears. Go for it.
Brilliant. That look, this has been such a great conversation, Steve. I'm glad we did it. I now understand your somewhat unorthodox LinkedIn tagline, which is human Swiss Army knife, problem solver, acquirer and nurturer of world-class talent, therapist, wine drinker, believer in a brighter future, and most importantly, lover of dogs. So that part's self-explanatory, but the human Swiss Army knife, I think I was curious about what you meant by that, but I think I understand it now. You've come up with some really innovative solutions to problems in our industry. It's funny, on the dogs, I was looking at your website earlier. I noticed that at least five of your members of staff are canines.
We've got 15 dogs in the business. So 15 dogs and I think 27, 28 people. So yeah, our human to dog ratio is through the roof. They're good for well-being, of course, Mark. But and if you're a dog person, you get it. If you're not, you probably don't. But yeah, dogs are a big deal.
I liked the job titles. This is on your cubedtalent.co.uk, and it's Meet the Team page. I like Dora, who's in charge of security. You've got Dottie, who's head of food testing. Maisie, head of well-being.
Yeah.
Great job titles there.
Yeah, I just on that, Mark, you know, I think humor and just not taking yourself too seriously has been something that has served me well. I don't think it's something you switch on or switch off. I think it's part of your personality. But, you know, I think having points of reference that help you sort of calibrate what's important, what's really important, and what's not really important. Because being non-corporate, you know, I think letting your personality out and engaging with people through your personality, through your values, through your worldview, through who you really are, not the role you play. I think that's really important. Maybe, you know, you wouldn't survive and prosper in corporate environments where, there's a certain groupthink. But I think at the end of the day, in a business that's about people and therefore by definition about individuals, Be an individual.
Absolutely. Just one point on that is I work with a lot of solo or small recruitment business owners, and there seems to be a tendency to want to have websites which give the impression that you're a massive company and there's no like pictures of the owner on there because they don't want, they're petrified of the client finding out it's really just them. I think that's a mistake. People are going to buy, ultimately it's, you can't hide that for long, right? You know, and people, if they are going to do business with you, they're going to buy because of you. You are part of, your personal brand is really, especially for a one person business, is also the business brand. And so you should really, you know, be an individual and put your, be approachable, put your human side across.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Steve, I've really enjoyed this. I hope we can do it again someday.
No problem, Matt. Thank you very much first for me. So I'm grateful.
Great. One more thing before you go. I wanted to be able to give a plug to your charity. Of course, people can find you on LinkedIn and they can follow up with cubedtalent.co.uk. So it's Stephen with a V Street on LinkedIn. But what is the Martin's House Children's Hospice?
So Harry and Grace is, the Harry and Grace's Big Bike Ride is our sort of platform, our theme for doing a lot of our sort of fundraising activity. So Harry and Grace were brother and sister. Harry died at 8 years old. Grace died at 13 years old. We're very close to the parents and the family. So when I was saying earlier about having points of reference that just keep us grounded and remind us of what can happen in life and therefore what's really important and worth getting stressed about and what's not, Harry and Grace are my go-to point of reference and the family and how they dealt with all of that. So Martin House Children's Hospice is where Harry and Grace were both cared for. And just as importantly, where their sibling and their surviving sibling and their parents have been cared for. So we were into the whole cycling bit, links into our sort of well-being, that whole activity, sense of community, keeping fit, fresh, outdoors, all of that stuff. So that's our platform and our theme, the Harry and Grace's Big Bike Ride. So we've done the Yorkshire White Rose. We're doing a virtual Yorkshire to Paris. And we ask people to kind of clock their miles, whether it's leisure cycling, semi-serious or serious cycling, and try and get some sponsorship for the miles they're doing. So that's kind of what it is. And, you know, we love it. Yeah.
Well, I'll definitely get the link from you where people can find out more about that and how to get involved or donate. So, all right, Steve, great. Well, enjoy the rest of your day. And here's to a more prosperous and healthy 2021.
Hear, hear. All right, Mark, pleasure.
All right, take care.
Yeah, you too.
Bye now.
Take care. Bye-bye.